Session number 10880.
Mr. Pure Real 3.
Into the field, and Wormout Village was on our right, and firing came from the village, and also there was fire coming from forward of us, which we later discovered was fire from our own troops, a Vickers machine gun detachment, who had mistaken us for Germans, and then shortly after ceased firing at us. We ran across the field, and halfway across was a small stream or river, which we went down. And I vividly remember this field because it was a pea field, and the peas were growing there. And we crossed the river and went up a slope, heading towards a road. And we got to this road, but no one knew where to go. And some were saying, let's go right, some left. And then Sergeant Jones on his motorcycle came along this road and said, if you go right, you're in trouble because the Germans are all in Wormout. He said, go left, and on the right is a farm, and you'll find that what remains of the battalion are gathering there. So we went along the road to the farm, and sure enough, the remains of headquarter company, or battalion headquarters, was in there. And I suppose when we arrived and we all gathered together, there must have been about 80 of us then. And time was unreal, because we had started fighting in the morning and we'd lost all concept of time, really. And it must have been 6 o'clock in the evening then that we got to this farm, because it was May, and we'd been at the farm about an hour or hour and a half when it started to get dusk, and it was drizzling with rain then. Anyway, we were given another 10 rounds of ammunition each, and I think it was a tin of bully beef and a pack of biscuits between about six people. And that was the first food we'd had for days on end. And then under cover of the drizzle, just in the half light, we started marching out as the remains of the battalion, heading for Dunkirk. And after about 3 or 4 miles, we halted and was told to take up positions. And our particular position was round a pond. And we were told that we'd got to stay there until 11 o'clock in the evening. And we could see Wormout burning from the battle and everything, and could see various flares going up because the Germans communicated with flares a lot.
Who's in charge of you now?
We were just left. A sergeant had put us there. Sergeant Brown, I think, was, or Jones, one of the two, had put us there and said, remain here until 11 o'clock and we'll come and fetch you. And there was just the three of us there to cover this field, you see, which was on the right, as we were heading on the right of the road. And we stopped there till 11, getting more jittery and jumpy all the while. And soon enough at 11, he came back and said, I'm sorry, you lads, we've got to remain here till 12, but I'll come back at 12 o'clock and fetch you. And off he went. So we were there again for another hour, for this time getting really jumpy and frightened. And he did come back at 12 o'clock, because I had memories of when we were left on our own in the early part of the campaign. And we then went to a small village where we remained for the remainder of the evening. I suppose we must have got there about 3 or 4 in the morning, which gave us a bit of respite, and had a wash, and then started marching again towards Dunkirk. And that was when we could see the extent of the debacle, because for mile after mile there were vehicles, wrecked vehicles, burning vehicles, dead horses, light tanks upside down, guns being spiked, dead people about where they'd been bombed. and we eventually arrived at Bray Dunes.
What happened to you there?
Well, we got on the beach amongst the sand dunes, and there was some light bombing and strafing. And then we started looking for a boat.
This is still the three of you?
Yes, and we linked up with some more of our surviving battalion. But the three of us went off looking for a boat, because it didn't look as though anything was happening at the time. You know, there was no such thing as getting off a pier or anything.
You couldn't see any boats evacuating people?
Odd boats going backwards and forwards, but not a lot of them. And they were overloaded. So we found this boat. It was rather funny in retrospect, which was half waterlogged, but we tipped the water out and started paddling with our rifle butts.
Where did you find it?
Lying upside down on the beach. It was upside down. When we tipped it, it was under the water, you see.
You mean it was a rowing boat?
Yeah, it was a rowing boat under the water. And we dragged it up the beach and tipped the water out, because it was, when we pushed it back in the water, it was sort of half floating. So we tipped the rest of the water out and got into it. And we saw this huge, what looked to us like a big merchantman. And we said, row for that. And we're paddling away. And we got near it, because it wasn't far out. If we'd have known anything about boats in the sea, we'd have realised it was bottomed, really, beach. And when we got near it, there was a Royal Navy launch touring round, and they came over the loud hailer saying, stand off from that merchant ship, it is on fire and loaded with ammunition. So back to the beach we come, and by this time the boat sunk again, the rowing boat. It was waterlogged, and we met up with, I suppose, three or four of our regiment. One of them, a bloke named Stamp, who took charge, and we managed to get hold of a bridging pontoon, a canvas and wooden bridging pontoon. I don't know where we got it from, but that was half full of water, and it was quite heavy, but we tipped it up and tipped it out. And I suppose all together with other people, there must have been about 10 of us in there. Six of our regiment, us three sticking together all the while. And a couple of another regiment. And then an officer got in, a young officer, young subaltern. And Stamp said to him, right, you take over, sir. Oh, he said, I couldn't do that. And he said, well, we've no room for passengers, out. And chucked him out the boat. And then we made out to the sea, and we eventually got on board one of these Thames River boats, a small boat, which brought us back to Ramsgate.
How did you get on board?
Well, we just scrambled on board. And halfway across, back to England, a solitary German aircraft dropped a stick of bombs at us, but and when a target like that, he missed it.
Who was on board?
Oh, there must have been. We were jammed, in actual fact, we were ordered to throw our equipment, except arms, overboard, to make room for other people. And there must have been about a couple of hundred all jammed on this boat. And the one thing I remember about it, we were down below, and in one of the small holes forward, was all 2 gallon petrol tin, but they were full of water. I suppose ballast or something, or intended for the troops. And when we got back to Ramsgate, we got off at Ramsgate Harbour there, the marina.
When you say a Thames River boat, you mean a pleasure boat?
Well, it was difficult to tell, because it got a coloured awning on, you know, a red and white awning. But what confused me was the fact that it had got this hold with all these tins in. I presume it must have been a pleasure boat, and they were water-contained, as either for passengers who were using it as pleasure boat at some time, or to bring the stuff across to us.
What reception did you get at Ramsgate?
That was rather fantastic, really, because the first person spoke to us was a red cap, a military policeman. And he said, would you unload your weapons and put your ammunition in those boxes? I think between the three of us of our crew were still sticking together. But by this time, we'd met up with a couple more from our platoon, from the carrier platoon. And between us, I think we tipped about 10 rounds, which was all we'd got left into this bucket. And of course we hadn't had proper food and drink for days. And we turned round, and I'll always remember this, was two young ladies, must have been about 18 or 19, dressed entirely in white, because it was summer, obviously. And they said, would you like a sandwich? And the one had got a tray with two big enamel jugs of tea on, and the other one had got a tray stacked with sandwiches. And three hands went forward and all the sandwiches had gone. And we picked up these enamel jugs and we drank that tea, though it was cold water, although it was hot. And the look of astonishment on the faces of these young ladies was something to behold. I don't think they'd ever seen anyone do that before.
Were they part of an organisation?
Yes, they were the local people who'd come down to there to help the boats, to give them food and refreshment and stuff. Because don't forget, we were then beginning to be the tail-enders that were coming from Dunkirk. So the big rush, really, had come out of it.
So do you know the date that you crossed?
I reckon it must have been something like about the 2nd of June, 1st or 2nd of June, something like that.
Now, going back to Wormhout, we know that a massacre occurred there. Did you suspect that anything of that kind was going on whilst you were there?
No. We didn't know anything about the massacre until, I suppose it must have been either 1940s. It must have been 1944, when the CO gathered the battalion together and told us about it and referred to it as the Barn Incident.
Was there anything in the behaviour of the German troops at Wormhout that made you reflect with the benefit of hindsight that they might have committed a massacre?
No.
One thing that we haven't said was what division you were in. Can you tell me what you were telling me earlier off record about how you were in one division and transferred to another?
Yes, when we left England from Aldershot, we were in the 2nd Division. And when the BEF was being built up towards the end of 1939, beginning of 1940, we were then transferred to the 48th Division, which I understand was one regular battalion in a brigade to two territorial battalions.
Now, jumping ahead in the war, I think the next time that you were involved in action was D-Day. Can you tell me how you were involved in that, please?
Yes. After finishing training in Scotland, we moved down to a camp just outside of Hayward's Heath at Lindfield. The battalion was then completely re-equipped with new weapons, new vehicles and new clothing. Having completed that, we were then taken into Hayward's Heath, into the cinema, and Field Marshal Montgomery briefed us onto what was going to happen and the landing areas. And of course, all place names were in code. Strange enough, port, stout, all drink name. On return to the camp was sealed and guarded by armed guards, who were ordered to shoot if anyone attempted to get out.
What can you remember about Montgomery's address and the style in which it was given?
He came onto the stage and said, put your cigarettes out, clear your throats, make all the noise, and then keep quiet. And listen carefully to what I have to tell you. And his delivery and explanation was excellent. He had maps on the stage, and it was absolutely clear exactly what was going to happen and what the intention was, although the intention didn't materialise.
What was the intention from your memory of it?
Well, the intention was to land on the Normandy beaches, push for Caen, to obtain Caen on that first evening, on the night of D-Day, and then form up, really, a combat team comprising of infantry on tanks and supporting artillery, an attempt to push through and capture Falaise.
Which beach were you to land on, your unit?
Crikey. T.
Doesn't matter if you can't remember. Sword?
I think it was Sword Beach. What was it? Sword Gold? King.
Gold.
Red. We were on Red Beach, anyway. But we went with vehicles. And I was on... Our section was on landing ship tank 385, and we loaded at Gosport.
Which wave were you supposed to be in?
Second.
So you said that you were put under lock and key, as it were.
We put under lock and key, and no one was allowed to communicate with anyone outside. Even the mail was delivered to the gate in bags and left. And then the post corporal went and collected it where he couldn't say anything to the postman. And likewise, rations were delivered similar fashion. When the time came to move, which was probably a week before D-Day, or maybe a bit before that, we then drove by road down to just outside Gosport into a staging camp. The section commander, which was in this case myself, because we were a separate section of carriers going on our own, had to go and draw up 2 days' emergency rations for his section, which included chocolate, oatmeal biscuits, compote tea and waterproof cigarettes, 20 cigarettes for a day, and matches, waterproof matches, various other items. The following morning, or during the early hours of the morning, we then drove down to Gosport, to the concrete aprons, and loaded onto the landing ship. There were already tanks on board and ducks loaded with provisions. We then sailed and remained off the Isle of Wight, I suppose, for 5 or 6 days. And the sea was very choppy, conditions cramped. It wasn't pleasant at all being cooped up. We were summoned on the 4th, the morning of the 5th, I think, morning of the 5th of June. We were summoned to the skipper's cabin, or conference room, and handed out our maps and oversheets which showed German positions and everything, and told that originally the invasion was going to be on the 5th of June, but it had now been postponed for 24 hours because of weather conditions. So we sailed on the following evening at 5 o'clock and got off the Normandy coast and early hours of dawn. And, of course, bombardment was already going on then from Royal Navy ships and monitors and various other and aircraft strafing. And the initial troops had landed and taken the beach and the promenade and the immediate area behind when our battalions landed. But where the vehicles was concerned, we had to transfer off this landing ship tank onto a huge metal raft with a huge outboard on the back, operated by a sergeant in the Royal Marines. They were called rhinos. And we had to transfer off the landing craft about a mile out from the shore.
Onto the rhino,
which had no sides. It was just a flat metal sheet. And, of course, the landing craft was going up because it was rough weather, and the rhino was going down. So at times you had something like 15 or 20 foot gap between them. And the trick was to get a vehicle on the edge of the ramp of the landing craft, and as the rhino came up, because this Marine sergeant was excellent in the handling of it, came up under it, was to shoot forward with the vehicle.
He gave you the shout?
I was having to stand and watch and say, now, you see. And the driver just put his toe down and shot his eyes and went. Well, getting onto the rhino, that was all right, but what we were worried about was being metal and the metal tracks, whether it would slide and over the side, you see. And in the midst of all this, the Germans started returning, dropping some shells around the area, and sneak aircraft started coming through. But eventually we got our three vehicles on and went ashore just by Lyon-sur-Mer. Went into the outskirts of Lyon-sur-Mer and came under sniper fire. And we started to go down a main road which we had been told to go down, because we got aerial photographs and maps to show us. And I came across some Canadians digging in. And the one said, where are you going? I said, down the road. He said, well, there's only Germans down there. I turned around, went back to the outskirts of Lyon-sur-Mer and saw a military policeman and asked him if any of the Warwicks had gone through. And he said, yes, they're straight up towards Benneville. And we caught our rifle companies up by Benneville. They were held up by German resistance just the other side, about half a mile the other side of Benneville. And so we had to pull in and wait while they cleared, because this was token resistance at the time. So the full resistance had withdrawn off the coast itself. And we halted there for the night, in actual fact, because it was then getting late and the battalion started to dig in. And the following day, rifle companies moved off to contact, and we were told to stay where we were, and two other sections of carriers, plus the mortar platoon, etc., and anti-tank platoon, went forward with the rifle companies. Went through Beeville and Byville. There were two villages near each other. Well, having got through the farthest village, Byville, that one, they then had to advance on Le Bisey Wood, which was up a huge slope and was